So let's start. Welcome to the second lecture this week. So last time we came up with a super duper algorithm which kind of allows us to compute the least solution of systems of constraints over a complete lattice. And that was it was amazing that such an algorithm can be constructed with so little information about the nature of the values with which we compute. But still, now we have an algorithm. The question now remains whether does that algorithm serve its purpose? So does it really help us in our to achieve our goals? Now, so here again, a slightly more abstract version from what we have achieved. So we have we were successful. The starting point was that we have a start value d0 for the start point of our program, and we have functions for every edge in our control flow graph, and these functions are monotonic and transform a lattice element before at the start point of the edge into a lattice element at the end point of the edge. So once again, for available expressions, this lattice element is the set of available expressions. But there will be other applications where we are interested in other information, and then this will result in another lattice D and in other types of values. Yeah? But that is kind of the setting. This transformation for every edge is monotonic, and we have one value at the start point. And from that we extracted, that was our strategy, we extracted a set of constraints, one for every edge and one for the start point, which kind of relate the unknown pieces of information at the various program points. So that was this piece. And now, from that we were able now, under certain assumptions, namely that the lattice is well-behaving, in that, for example, it is finite, the complete lattice, and then we can kind of compute the least solution of that system. So that is the point. But that was kind of one way how to solve this problem. And this setting where we have a control flow graph together with these kind of annotations of the control flow graph, that is also called or has been called in the early days of compiler construction a monotonic analysis framework. And available expressions was one instance of such a monotonic analysis framework. And now if you have such a framework, so one possibility, and that is what we have kind of tried to make it algorithmic, make it algorithmically going, was to do this fixed point thing and solving the equations. But what comes from the application is something else. From the application comes what is called the merge over all paths solution. And that so here is this I, and you could think of this I is the abbreviation of information or invariant or something for the program point. And now what the application asks for is this I star. And this I star it does not kind of solve constraint systems, but it is defined by means of paths in the control flow graph. So if you have a path from pi, a path pi from the start point to a program point, then you can compose all the functions along the path and apply it to the start point d0. That you can do for any complete lattice. It's just function composition and the application of a function to a value. That you can always do. And since this is an infinite set of lattice elements, and now you take the least upper bound of all of them, and that is the I star value for the V. Or you could also call it the merge over all paths. You take the contribution of all paths and then merge them by means of the least upper bound operator. Okay? And that is kind of that was the value which we have defined for available expressions. And now the question is, how does this value relate to the least solution of the constraint system? So this value I star is kind of has a mathematical definition, but it is not easily computable, or it is. We don't know how to compute it because it involves a least upper bound over an infinite set. And we would first have to spell out the infinite set and then do the least upper bound. And this we can't do. Yeah? So this is, the I star is only a mathematical definition. And the only thing what we have is the constraint system, which we can write down, and we have a method to solve it, which is means to compute a least solution. So now, and this statement, this theorem from the mid-70s now is interesting. It is by Kamm and Ullmann. It relates these two kind of entities, the thing which we can compute and the thing which is mathematically desirable. And it says that the thing which we can compute, which is the solution, a solution of the constraint system, is always an upper bound to the I star. In particular, the least solution is an upper bound to the I star. So please note that what we might have hoped for, what we might have hoped for, that there would be an equality, this is not guaranteed by this theorem. So these two things, like the mathematical merge over all path definition and the solution of the constraint system, at least this theorem does not tell us whether they are the same or not. So this is perhaps a bit disappointing, but here still I give you a picture of Jeffrey Ullmann. I guess he was prolific in producing all kinds of textbooks. He was involved in writing down. Compiler books on compiler construction, but also on databases and VLSI design and all stuff of things. And I would guess he was kind of the head of a factory of textbook writers. I guess he had a nine-tailed cat by which he kind of threatened his PhD students to write these books, and if not, they would be cruelly punished, or I don't know, would not receive their PhD. I don't know. And by that, he became co-author of virtually everything. Kamm, I guess, is a PhD student of his in the early days. So now it's already 40 years ago. We could celebrate 40th birthday of that theorem. So now, how would we prove that? So here, you see, the point is, if this theorem says, if we have a solution of any solution of the constraint system, then it is an upper bound to the merge over all paths, which is a least upper bound to some values. So this in particular means that I of V is an upper bound to any of these values. So it is not necessarily the least upper bound, but it is an upper bound. So we have to prove that this I of V exceeds the value which is returned if we take the transformation for the path pi and apply it to the D0. Now, this is a statement which we have to prove for every path pi. Pi can be very long, so the only thing what comes to our minds how to prove it is to do induction on the length of pi. So here it is. So we start with epsilon, and then we ask ourselves, so we kind of again go for the definition. If the path is epsilon, the empty transformation applied to D0, this is just D0. And now what is the value of I returned for start? Well, the constraint for the start node of the program is that it is at least as big as D0, so D0 is less or equal to that, so therefore this is simply true by definition. Yeah? So we see here the foundation of the induction is the base case is satisfied. Now let's go for the step. So the step means that the pi is not the empty path, but it is a pi prime and a last edge, k. And the k goes from some program point u to some program point v. And now then, let's see. So this for the pi prime, we know, because it's shorter than pi, we can apply the induction hypothesis and assume that the transformation of pi prime applied to D0 will be less or equal to the than the value less or equal to the value which is returned by I for u. So it is less or equal than I of u. Okay, so that we kind of may assume. Actually, here is something missing. There should be a prime. Induction hypothesis for pi prime. Now, that means, now let's see. So what is then the value of pi applied to D0? Now, by definition, this is that we first apply the pi prime to D0 and then the transformation of the last edge. So it's just that. Now, this k is, the transformation for k is monotonic. So if we replace the argument by something larger, and that we have kind of, that we know that this I of u is larger, or at least equally in size, by the induction, by this yellow inequality, so then we obtain something which is also the same or larger. So therefore, by monotonicity of k and the induction hypothesis, the yellow one, we obtain that this must be, so that this here holds. And then, the next, now we have this beast here, the transformation of K applied to I of u. Now then, since I is a solution of the constraint system, this must be less or equal to this value, because this is a constraint in the constraint system. And so, therefore, since I is the solution, we end up also, we have this last inequality, and therefore, reading everything together, we have proven that pi of D0 is less or equal than I of V. And that's what we wanted to prove. So you see, it's a very simple proof, and it's amazing that you can make a PhD out of it, but it was 40 years ago. So these were other, so this was a different world. Now, so that proves it, and what kind of, famous theorem, but what is now, but we are completely disappointed. At least I, reading this theorem would be, I am, always when I read it, I'm always completely disappointed, because we wanted to have this merge over all path, and then we had this brilliant idea, and the only thing what we get is an upper bound, and it's not the real thing. Now, should we kind of be disappointed about an upper bound? What is the answer? Well, the answer is yes and no. So, yes, because an upper bound could also be top. Yeah, so that is an upper bound. Even the, so this merge over all path could be kind of very small value, but the constraint system gives us perhaps only top, and that means we learn nothing. Top means always we learn nothing, and that means we can do no optimization. So in reality, the merge over all path would be very small, and we could do a lot of optimization. So in that sense, we are disappointed. But on the other hand, if you're optimistic, it might be, and that is kind of a matter of practical experience, this solving the constraint system is at least something which we can do, and it is an upper bound, so it's a safe approximation. Let's assume that we, for the available expressions this means. Upper bound, it could be a subset of the really available expressions. And that is good, because that means, well, our analysis will perhaps fail to find some available expressions, but every expression which it finds is really an available expression. So in that sense, we can do the optimization whenever the algorithm tells us so. Yeah? So in that sense, the analysis at least gives us safe information on to which we can base our optimization. So that's the good news. On the other hand, one might ask, is it really the case that they are different? So maybe only the theorem is Kamp was too stupid. Yeah. So maybe there is somebody else who could come up with a better theorem, telling us that they are the same. And the answer is no. In saying that it's just an upper bound. So no, in that it is, you cannot in general hope that they are the same. But and now comes another famous PhD thesis. Kildall came up and he found that there's a sufficient condition which is quite frequent and not completely unrealistic to find in applications, and under this extra condition the least upper bound, this merge over all path, is the same as the least solution of the constraint system. And this sufficient condition is that these functions K are distributive. So maybe I can show you the picture of the person who found it before I go. So it is this guy. So Gary Kildall, so he's now long dead, virtually always has been on the loser side, in that he had ingenious ideas, put into operating systems, for example, which in the end, by history, have not proven to be successful, but not because they were not good or smart, but because economic affairs and politics is different. There are different rules. So, as you know, Microsoft, at least the early versions of the Microsoft operating systems, were not the best, but they were the company was the smartest to push its products into the market, and the customers then followed that road. And so other competing systems, which were perhaps technologically more advanced, were kind of died out. So in that sense, he was on the loser side, but he was a bright guy, and he did a lot of practical and useful things. But for us here, he is remembered for that observation that distributivity kind of saves the world to a small extent at least. So now what does it mean for a function to be distributive? That means, or at least we call it distributive, if the following is the case. Assume you have a least upper bound over a set, and the set is non-empty, and you apply the function to that least upper bound. Then it is the same as if you applied the function f to all the elements in the set and take the least upper bound then. So in that sense, the application of f commutes with least upper bounds, but only with non-empty least upper bounds. So that's a point. That's an important point. Yeah? So that is then in this. So there are two other notions which are perhaps related, and that is the function f is strict if it commutes with the bottom element. So that means f of bottom is bottom. And so now what is the least upper bound over the empty set? It is bottom. So this means the only thing, if you want to drop, so if you drop this extra condition, so I write it in black, if you drop that, so if F commutes with all least upper bounds, then it would also commute with the least upper bound over the empty set. And that would mean it would F would be strict. Yeah? Because the least upper bound over the empty set is bottom, though that means F applied to bottom, that is the left-hand side, would be the same as the least upper bound over F applied, so over the empty set, which is at bottom. Yeah? So distribute, if you take a function which is distributive and strict, then you have a function which is totally distributive, which means it kind of commutes with all least upper bounds. Okay? And so now that a function is totally distributive, that is, it commutes with all least upper bounds, that is something which is not, it occurs in nature, but it distributive functions are more frequent. So let us look at one of my favorite examples, which is a function over sets, which takes an argument x, intersects with a, and takes the union with b. And where? What is it? Is it strict? So assuming that the ordering of sets is set inclusion. Is it strict? So this is easy. You just plug in the empty set. The empty set intersected with A is the empty set. Union with B is different from the empty set. If B is not the empty set. Yeah? And on the other hand, if the ordering is upside down, what happens if you plug in U, which is the topmost element or the least element in the ordering turned upside down? So if you insert U, then U intersected A is A union B is not necessarily equal to U. Besides, A union B is U. Then it's again strict, but otherwise it would not be strict. Okay? So this function is in general not strict. But distributivity always holds, because if you apply F to x1 union x2, we would kind of have to, it's an example, so that I only do the binary union. In general, you would have to do it for an arbitrary non-empty union, but the argument would be the same. So what could we do? Well, we spell out the definition of F, and then we apply the distributivity laws. So A intersected x1 union x2 is A union intersected x1 union A intersected x2 union B. And then this union B can be kind of, we can duplicate it, union B, and rearrange, and then we get fx1 union fx2. So that is as soon as the argument is a non-empty union, then things are easy, and then it commutes. Okay? So that is this function, which is kind of very frequent in program analysis, is a distributive function. And we could do the same thing with the union, with the intersection. If we take a x1 intersected x2, so for the ordering upside down, then I guess things would be, it's a little bit more complicated to calculate through, but it would hold nonetheless. Also, if you like, we could try to do it. I hope did not promise too much. So let's write it in red. F of x1 intersected x2. So this would be A intersected x1 intersected x2 union B. Okay, so from that we do not see very much. But then let's see what happens if we look at f of x1 intersected f of x2. So that would be A intersected x1 union B intersected A intersected x2 union B. And now we have to calculate a little bit. Hopefully I do not miscalculate. So we have to do this, you apply distributivity and get A intersected x1 intersected x2 union A intersected x1 intersected B union A intersected x1 intersected x2 intersected B union B. So what do we learn from that? How can we simplify? Why should be the two things be the same? What kind of extra law can we apply? Now we see we have a B here, so that perhaps I make it in green. So here's a B. And here we have A intersected X1 intersected B, which is a subset of B. If I take the union with B, it simply doesn't matter. So therefore, this one can be cancelled out, and the same holds for that one. So in cancelling that out, the remaining two terms which we have here, namely this one, the two green ones, are exactly the same as these. So therefore, they are the same. Okay? So we succeeded. Okay, so distributivity holds in both cases, both if we look the ordinary ordering or we put the ordering upside down. Now what happens, so let us look at another example, our increment function. Is that distributive? So what would you say? Is it or is it not? So is it strict? So that is, we have to apply it to zero. This is the bottom element. F applied to 0 is 1, okay, so that is different from zero, so therefore it is not strict. And distributive, if you have a least upper bound over a non-empty set, so that means it is the least upper bound over, and you compare it. So, well, if X contains infinity, then the least upper bound is infinity, and F applied to infinity is infinity. So then in that case it is the same. And if X does not contain infinity, then the least upper bound of all the X's, well, if it's a finite value, so if it's a bounded set, then you apply F to that maximal element, and so you increment that by 1, and that's the value on the left-hand side. And on the right-hand side, if you first increment everything by 1 and then take the least upper bound, you obtain the same thing. And if it's an unbounded set, then this would be unbounded, and therefore F applied to infinity would be infinity, and on the other hand, that would be an unbounded set, and therefore the least upper bound would also be infinity. So therefore, whenever X is non-empty, distributivity holds. So the increment function is distributive, but not strict. Okay? So that is, we have now seen a lot of, at least two interesting functions which are distributive. Now, I want to show you that not everything is distributive. So here is a function, so you take the addition. Addition is a function from pairs of, say, natural numbers into natural numbers, So the D1 is n union infinity squared, and the D2 is n union infinity not squared. And you take the sum, and now the question is, what would strictness mean? Strictness would mean you apply to the least element. And what is the result? So the least element in this lattice D1 is 0,0. And plus applied to the pair, to the argument 0 and 0, returns 0. So therefore, strictness is given. Now what about distributivity? So that is, we apply this function f. So here's an example. So you see, as it does not hold, distributivity does not hold, I only have to provide one example where it fails. So here is an example of two argument tuples. So the one argument tuple is 1,4 and the other one is 4,1. And in each case, if you apply the least upper bound of these two tuples, you have to take the least upper bound in each component, which is 4 for each component. And f applied to 4,4 gives us 8. Now if I apply f to 1,4, this means I have to add 1 plus 4, this is 5. And on the other hand, if I apply f to the tuple 4,1, this is also 5. And the least upper bound of two fives is still 5. And 5, at least to my knowledge, to the best of my knowledge, is different from 8. And so for that reason, distributivity fails here. Okay. So then that is, so we see, now what did we see? So we saw several examples where strictness fails, and but distributivity holds, and at least one example where it is the opposite way around. Another thing is, distributivity only says something about commutation with non-empty least upper bounds. It says nothing about monotonicity. But there is an interesting, it is a minor observation, but still a useful one to note, that a function which is distributive is also always monotonic. And why is this? Because we may first convince ourselves that A less or equal to B in a complete in a partial order or in a, let's say, in a complete lattice, is this holds exact if and only if the least upper bound of A and B is B. Okay, now. Why is this? Is this obvious to you? Now, assume that this is the case. Then the least upper bound of B is B, and B is also an upper bound of A. So B is obviously the least upper bound of both, and there could not be a smaller one. Now, on the other hand, if B is the least upper bound of A, if B equals the least upper bound of A, B, then this means that B is at least as big as B, okay, so that is clear, but also at least as big as A. So therefore it is larger than, it cannot be smaller. So therefore the two properties are really, these two kind of statements are equivalent, and that also tells you when you have to implement a complete lattice, instead of providing the ordering an implementation of a order of the ordering relation, it suffices if you provide the binary operation least upper bound. Then you can kind of express by it, and if you have equality for sure, clearly, then you can express the ordering relation by that. Yeah. Now, okay, so how can we, so now we want to prove that F, sorry, so this is what we want to prove, and in fact the only thing what we prove is that this, so then we use this equivalence, and that means we start with one side, for example, with this one, this FA applied to least upper bound FB. So that is, now by distributivity, this implies, so is, this can be rewritten to F least applied to the least upper bound of A and B. Now, and if A is less than B, then A least upper bound B is the same as B. So this means as if A is less or equal to B, then F of B is less, is the same as F of A least upper bound F of B, and that means that F of A is less or equal to F of B. So by that we have proven that indeed if F commutes with non-empty least upper bounds, or more particular if it commutes simply with binary least upper bounds, then it is necessarily monotonic. Okay, so now then we have to add this. If then we make one extra assumption, namely that all program points are reachable from the start point of our program in the control flow graph. Is this a real restriction? Where are programs containing program points which are not reachable in the control flow graph from the start point of the program? Do such programs exist? Yes, so if you have that code, it really happens. And the point is that if you think of code for embedded controllers or so, you could have a while true loop. And then it could very well happen that this is meant, that the program is meant to run forever. But clearly in practical controllers, even if there is a while true loop, you would still have some kind of exit, because there always can be an emergency or an error or something, and then you would kind of break and go to some error state and leave and quit. And so in that sense, virtually every program every program point is reachable, perhaps only in some kind of emergency thing, but usually there is a path to the exit. But at least it is a syntactical restriction, and we did not do this restriction so far. So, but on the other hand, if there is a program point which is not reachable, then we can simply remove it, because it is not reachable, at least we can remove it from the control flow graph. We may not remove it from the program for syntactical reasons, but at least we can remove it from the control flow graph, and for a non-reachable program point, we may assume anything anyway. Okay. Now, here comes then the theorem by Kildall, and interestingly, this Kildall theorem is older than the one by Kamm and Ullmann. And this was an early Popple paper. I think Popple started in 1971, and I guess this is the second Popple or so. So Popple, you know Popple? Principle, so it's nothing with a nose, but it has something to do with principles of programming languages, and it is kind of the flagship conference in the area of compilers and programming language theory. His theorem is that when all effects of edges are distributive, then the merge overall path and the least fixed point solution are the same. So that is his theorem. One must say there's a side remark, which I may say, so it's a little bit a thing. So Kildall had this theorem, but he... I think in the original formulation it is a little bit flawed, because it did not make the restriction assumption that these edge effects are distributive, but that they are totally distributive, and virtually these functions at the edges are. The transformations at the edges are totally distributive. So that in that sense, although his examples were only distributive, and so the remedy was, so in this sense his theorem is wrong, literally wrong. one has to refine it a bit to go from total distributivity to distributivity and add this assumption. And then everything is fine. So that's Kildall. And now let's see how we can prove it. So the first thing is we know already that what we have proven here is this direction, that the least solution of the constraint system is an upper bound to this I star, to the merge over all path. What remains to be proven is that the opposite thing, that is this ordering. And one possibility to do that is, well, the I of V, the least solution, is a solution. If we show that I star of V is also a solution of the constraint system, then clearly the least solution will be smaller or equal to any other solution, and therefore we are done. So the only thing what we have to prove is, oh, I do not have to cancel it out, but I want to prove it, so that I star is a solution, and that means that this I star satisfies all constraints. So no induction, only look at all the constraints and check whether they are satisfied. Okay, so that's now our on our agenda. How can we deal with it? So the first thing is, what is I star? We look at this first constraint with the start node. So I star of start is, again, it is the least upper bound over all the contributions of all paths from start to start. There could be a loop around the start point, which is perhaps not so likely in realistic programs, but they could. But at least there's the possibility to reach start from start by simply the empty path. So that is this set here. I wanted to make it in red. This set here contains the empty the effect of the empty path applied to D0. So this is an element of it, of that set, and therefore it is, as it is an element, it's the value produced by the effect of the empty set applied to D0. This value is contained in the set and therefore is less or equal to the least upper bound of that set. Okay? Now let us kind of technically look what we have said. So if this one is less or equal to that one, so then let's take a closer look at the effect of epsilon applied to D0. The effect of epsilon is the identity transformation, so there's nothing to be done, so that is equal to D0. So by that we have proven that D0 is less or equal to I star of start, and that means that the constraint for the start point is satisfied. Okay? Now we have to check that in the same style, the property for every other edge K. So assume that this edge K goes from a program point U to a program point V. So we spell out what it means, what I star of V is. So once more, it is the least upper bound over all path, over the contributions, computed by taking all paths reaching V and applying their effect, their combined transformation to the start point, to this, yeah. So that is the definition of I star of V. Now, on the other hand, let's look, perhaps go down here to the bottom end. Here, so that I should kind of make in green, because these are the two endpoints which we have to relate. If we kind of relate these two green issues by equalities or greater or equal, then we are done. So thinking backward, we could also push there the definition of we kind of expand the I star U by its definition. So this arrives us here. So we have to apply the transformation of K to the set of the Now the contributions of all paths reaching not V but U. Okay? So these are the pi primes. And we have to take the least upper bound of all these contributions. And then we have to apply the K to that least upper bound. Now, thinking backward, that these, the set of all, here is K applied to a least upper bound. So that asks, reminds us of the fact that K, the transformation for K, is distributive. So we wonder whether this beast here, this set here, is over which the least upper bound is taken in the argument of K, whether this is an empty set or a non-empty set. So it, once again, it is the set of, it is has values for each path reaching broken point U. So it's non-empty if there is at least one path reaching U. Okay, but that is what we kind of, is our assumption, that every broken point is reachable by at least one path. So therefore, the set where the least upper bound is taken over is a non-empty set. Okay, so therefore, K, the transformation for K, commutes with this least upper bound. And that is a good news, because that allows us to rewrite it here upward to pull the least upper bound out. So now we have the least upper bound out, and that means now inside we have to apply the transformation of K to all the values returned by the pi primes applied to the transformation of pi primes applied to D0. Okay, so now this thing in here, K, the transformation of K followed after the applied to the transformation of pi prime is the same as the transformation of pi of the path pi prime and then K. Yeah, because that's the definition. So we prolong the pi prime by K. So now we have paths which first go to U and then make one more step to reach V. And now, and then we take, afterwards we take the least upper bound of all the values computed in that way. Now then, now we consider two things. So we consider this set of paths and compare it with that set of paths. So the paths which are over each path returns a value, and then we kind of collect all these values. But now we look just at the set of paths which give rise to these values. So here in that, in this line here, we have paths to V, which are constructed in such a way that you first go to U and then make one take the step from using HK, and the other one is taking all paths to V. So these paths need not go through U; they could travel in another along another road, but it is at least a superset. So we have more values in the first line than in the second line. So if you have more values and we take the least upper bound, then we get a larger value, or at least not a smaller value. So that gives us this inequality. And the rest is all equalities. So that is all together. We have found that the green thing here is at least as big as this one. And that's what we wanted to prove. And the key point here, the key step here, which is where we really relied on distributivity, was when we pulled out the least upper bound operator from the argument of the transformation of K in front of it. So here we have made use of the distributivity and also of the non-emptiness of the set of reachable paths. Okay, is a question here? So you see also this proof is not, we would not be, if you know that it holds, could be a student's exercise and you would all be able to do it, I guess. So, but in the 70s, this was all new and people were excited about it, and it was extremely useful for them because that made their compiler optimizations going. Without that, they would not be able to do the analysis for trigger to trigger their transformations. Okay, so now, now with this kind of corrected theorem by Kildall, we have found a sufficient criterion or sufficient criteria under which this the least solution of the constraint system coincides with the merge overall path. Now we might wonder: is it optimal? The theorem, could we improve it? Could we drop some of the assumptions? So could we drop, for example, the reachability assumption? And the answer is no. We cannot. In that sense, the theorem is optimal, and there is no way how to improve it, perhaps by what fancy proof techniques soever. So here is a tiny example why reachability cannot be abandoned. So here's a control flow graph, and there's something which is not reachable. Namely, all that stuff here is not reachable. So perhaps I should not mark it in green, but I should mark it in black. In black. So this is not reachable. We assume that at the start point we have the value 7. So D0 is 7. So then if you now let us think of the program, of the value of the program at the program point 2. At program point 1, we have 0, because we start for the least fixed point computation, we start with the bottom element for every program point. So we have 0 at program point 1. Then we do this inc thing to obtain the value for the program point 2, and inc of 0 is 1. So inc of 0 is 1. So therefore the least fixed point solution of at program point 2 is the value 1. So here I have kind of implicitly done round robin iteration, so there are no cycles. So following the ordering of the edges, we directly get the solution. Okay? So the least solution, and actually in fact the least solution for returns the value 1 for program point 2. Now, what is the merge overall path for program point 2? Well, 2 is not reachable by any path starting at program point 0, at program start. So therefore, we have to take the least upper bound over the empty set. And the least upper bound over the empty set, no matter how the transformation at any edge is, the least upper bound over the empty set is always the empty set. So therefore, we obtain as the I star 0 and as the I value for 2, 1, which are different. Okay? So you see, we cannot, if we give up reachability, we lose coincidence. But on the other hand, if we kind of do this again, if we solve the constraint system, ignoring reachability, so this value here is still an upper bound over the I star, because that is Kahn-Ullmann, there was no reachability assumption, so that also holds here, so it's still a safe over approximation, and that's fine. So that's then is fine, but it's not the same. Okay. So now let us kind of put things together. So what do we have? So this availability of expressions had the transformations at the edges. What we had were of this particular, were generally of this form. We have an X, sorry, we have an X, we have a union with an A, and then we remove a B. And now, well, that is kind of, in some sense, not the same as X intersected A union B, but it's closely related and in fact can be rearranged in that way. And also we do not have the ordering the least upper bound operation union, but the least upper bound operation intersection. And so here again I have kind of spelled out the proof that this type of transfer functions, so this type of transfer functions is this type of transfer functions is distributive, but I have shown you for this type of function that it is distributive for the union and for the intersection operator, and therefore we need not repeat it here again. But from that we realize that all transformations for availability of expressions are occurring at edges are distributive, and therefore this merge over all path, which was the best solution which we could, the best values which we could hope for, are in fact equal to this solution, to the least solution of our constraint system, and therefore can be computed. So in that sense this merge over all path is computed by our round robin iteration over this system of constraints. So that is kind of the intermediate result which we obtain from our longish discussion of all the theoretical background. Is there a question? So in general, however, this we are not as lucky, but then this round robin iteration for the constraint system, which was our work, is our currently our working horse for the for solving constraint systems, at least gives us something which is an upper bound to the MOP and therefore can be used for optimization. Okay, so now let us see. So that was all the story for the available expressions, and now you might wonder, 1 month we have worked on that. Now we desperately want more. So what else can we do? So let us now quickly move on. What kind of other optimizations could we apply our techniques to? So the next thing, which at least comes to my mind, is another observation. If you write down a few example programs, there could be things like that. Code like this one. So here I have an assignment to an X. Here I have an assignment to another variable, and here I have a second assignment to the X. So that means the value, the first assignment to the X, this one, is kind of redundant. Or it's not redundant, it is a kind of an assignment to a variable which nobody ever cares about. Why? Before somebody is able to read this variable, a new value is written into it, and then that value might be used. So therefore, it is not harmful simply to cancel out this assignment. Okay? So therefore, we would say that at that we could say at that program point one, X is a dead variable. Yeah, because before X is used, there is a brilliant new assignment to the X. So whatever is written, whatever is the value at program point of X at program point one, it simply does not matter. It does not affect the rest of the execution, and therefore the whole assignment to X at program point one can be removed. And again, by this removal, we have improved the program. Now, So assignments to dead variables can be removed. And now, still, if you think of this kind type of program, you might say, it is true This is an optimization, but an optimization which is virtually useless because I do not write such code. And this is true. Typically, a user, a programmer, will not write that code. But we will see that we will introduce, we will have other optimizations which modify the code. And then one step will be, one such possibility is to improve the code is not to remove something, but to render certain variables dead at the program point. So by that, by killing variables, or you, this could be done, for example, by removing uses of variables, by that we kill variables at certain program points, and by that we make certain assignments to these variables useless, and then this removal of assignments to dead variables becomes suddenly a useful, if you like, garbage collection method of collecting superfluous and computations. So that is the reason why we kind of consider that optimization as is, because then we can, once we have done all kind of other optimizations, we then do in between always removal of assignments to dead variables, and that garbage collects certain assignments away. So okay, so now let's see how we kind of define what it means for a variable to be live at the program point. And we say the variable is live at a program point U. Okay, so what does it mean? So the value of X is useful. Now, and then now comes suddenly an interesting new concept which we have not kind of dreamt about. Whether the variable X is the value of variable X is useful is not determined relative to the past, but it is a notion referring to the future. So that means there must be a path starting at U going to the endpoint of the program, and along that path, somebody reads the variable of X, the value of X. Yeah? So it's something about the future. And that's, in some sense, it's not about reaching path, but it's kind of a starting path. So that's kind of a opposite notion, opposite phenomenon, which is kind of, so that's a kind of philosophically interesting that we have here also, that it's not only the past which matters, sometimes also the future. Okay. And now, so it could be that this path, now what is, and then there is another issue which is an important, that we kind of, this path goes from, starts at the program point U and goes to the end point. And now the question is, what will happen at the end point? What happens at the end point of a program? Is it the case that at the end point of a program, all variables are dead? Or is it not the case that all variables are dead? So that is kind of, again, a philosophical question, and we might do an introspection and wonder what we would expect. What would you say? At the end point of the program, should all variables be dead, or all variables be live, or some variables dead, some variables be live? So if they are practically useless at the end of the program, then they are all dead.
Yes, but what we want, we don't want this one we want to avoid.
Well, at the end of the program, so then what the values of the variables, so if we think of the variables as the interface to the world, and so they constitute our output, then clearly their value matters because the environment reads the variables. And then they are alive. If you consider the variables of your program as local variables of your program, and the communication with the outside world is through writing to memory, because it's, you have a memory mapped I/O, then the variables are local, and therefore their value at the end of the program does not matter. And then you would call them dead. So both choices are somehow depend on the semantics of the or the environment within which your program runs. And if you think, in particular, if you think that you have a that your control flow graph, the program which we analyze, is not a full program, but it's the control flow graph for just one procedure. So in that sense, then for a procedure, there are procedure local variables, and they would be considered as dead at the end. But there are also global variables, and a variable holding the return value would be a global variable, because the outside world will notice, will be able to read it. So one would have to distinguish between local and global variables. Locals are dead, globals are alive. So in that sense, one has, depending on the application of where we plug our analysis into, we have to make different choices for what is live at program exit or not. And therefore, I have kind of here, this notion here, kind of I have taken the liberty to parameterize the liveness by a set of variables which is considered to be live at program exit. And that we have to choose and adapt to our application, whatever we like to have. Okay? So that's why this X is there. So, okay, so now we wonder, back to our definition. So X, now we want to say, when is it live along this path? When we assume this path goes to the program exit, and we have also fixed a set capital X of variables which we consider as live at program exit. Okay? So now, there are several possibilities under which X could be live. So one possibility is the following. X is one of these super-duper interesting variables, capital X. And this pi simply does not has another definition of X. So X remains unchanged until the very end, and there somebody else, the outside world, will read out the X. So then clearly X must be live. So that is this thing here. The alternative is that P can be decomposed into a first part, a prefix, pi 1, and pi 1 simply does not affect the X. So there's no definition of the X. But following this pi 1, there is a single edge K which reads the X. Okay, so then we cannot throw away the X, because there is, in the future, an action, some edge, which is traversed and does something where the value of X is read. And so then X would be considered as live. Okay? So here is this decomposition. And now I used here these strange, without definition, things like K is a use of X, or some edge is a definition of X. Intuitively, it is clear what it means, but we can make it. We can make this. What is the use? What is the definition? We can make that very clear by just going through the possible labels of an edge and see which variables are used and which variables are defined. So clearly defined are variables only when they occur on the left-hand side of an assignment or of a read from memory, and they are used whenever they occur in the expressions occurring in the statement, namely either in the condition or in the right-hand side or in the index expressions for memory reads or writes. Yeah, okay, so that is kind of just to fix our agreement what it means for a variable to be used at an edge or defined at an edge. Okay? So, And now a variable which is not live at u along this path pi, that we would call dead. And so let us quickly see an example what it means. So here is a path from program point from the start point 0 to the end point 3, and we assume for simplicity that no variable is live at program exit. Now, what is live at program point 3? Well, we go backward. At program point 3, nothing is live, because that was our convention. And at program point 2, so we have to see, okay, y is used. So therefore, at program point 2, y is live. 3 and x, since it is not live, it is dead. Now, at program point 1, y is defined. So therefore, is and there is no subsequent use of any other variable along that path. So therefore, nothing is live at program point 1. And at program point 0, y is red, and therefore y is live. And x is always dead. Okay? Is there a question? Okay. Now, that was, by that we just, like for availability of expressions, we considered one path at a time and considered the notion of availability along that path. And then we used that notion to define what does it mean to be available at a particular program point. And so we proceed here as well. When is a variable live at a program point U, irrespective of a particular path? Well, then it is, if it is, X is live at a program point U, if it is live along some path. Why? So if it were dead, we would cancel out the assignment to X. But if we do not know which path is taken, and if there is only one path where it is live, then this one might be taken, and then our canceling out the assignment to X would be wrong. So we must be, if there is only one path along which X is live, then we must consider X as live, because we cannot exclude that this path is taken. Yeah? So, therefore, this sum here. And otherwise, it is called dead. Okay, so now our goal is, in order to trigger the information, we need the information for all program points U. We need to determine which variables are live or dead. And that's the question of how we can compute it. And, okay, so now... how would we do it? And the idea is not really an idea anymore, but it's just the kind we try to follow the same path as we did for availability of expressions. We want for every edge, we kind of figure out a transformation, how sets of live or dead variables are transformed from one end point to the other of the edge in the control flow graph. Then we put up a constraint system, and then we run round robin, and then we hopefully have the live variables. That's the idea. So for that we have to fix again what is the values which we are after, with which we want to compute. Okay, so it's sets of variables. No longer sets of expressions, but now sets of variables. And for an edge, we may define the transformation on these sets induced by that particular edge in the control flow graph. And now, but there's now already an interesting point difference. Before, so for availability of expressions, the transformation took the value at the start point of the edge and transformed it into the end point of the edge. Now here, it is opposite, the opposite way around. We have a set of life variables at the end point, and we transform it into the set of life variables at the start point of the edge. Why? Because here, liveness is not defined relative to the past, but relative to the future. Liveness refers to the future, and therefore also the transformation goes in the opposite direction. So this, but that is whether an edge, whether it is traversed from left to right or from right to left, this is just a mirror operation, and we simply would technically then simply mirror all the control flow graph and then do the apply our framework to this mirror image. So in that sense, it's no the technically it doesn't make a difference, but philosophically it is at least something which we should remember. Okay, so now we have this transformation in the reverse direction, but still we would like to formalize the transformations. So what is the transformation of life variables for if we have a no-op operation? That is the easy case, because then what is life afterwards is also life before. So that is this one. Now what is if you we have a guard? So a guard, so this is a condition. So we come from inside an if statement and go before the if. Now clearly, so assume we have some variables which are live afterwards. So now traversing the guard in reverse direction. So then the first thing which we see now on the start point of the guard is the guard. And then we see the rest. So that means every variable which is used at the guard is used. So therefore, this is life. So this, therefore, the set of life variables at the endpoint must be extended with the set of variables used in that guard. Okay? So something is added to the set. Now comes the interest, so maybe this is also in that, this is the reading, writing to memory is in the same spirit. So that no variable changes its value. So therefore, whatever is life afterwards will also be life before. But some more variables are used here, and say these used variables are simply added to, must be added to the set L. Okay, so then remain our two interesting cases, namely the cases when we have an assignment. So there is something, a variable receives a new value, so that is X. If X was if X is live afterwards, then the value of X before this assignment might not necessarily be live, because it receives a new value. So therefore, it becomes dead. The value of X before this assignment is dead. So therefore, we have to remove it from L. But on the other hand, before X receives a new value, all variables from the right-hand side, E, are read, and therefore these make the variables live again. So they have been added. So let us make a little example to clarify the point. Simply X is assigned X plus 1. So what is the effect of that? Say to a set X, Y. So clearly, afterwards, this means afterwards there are uses of X which make X really useful. And here, so from that set at the end, from that set here, we have to remove the X because it receives a new value at that edge. But then on the other hand, the value of X before this edge was red, so therefore it was made live again. So at first it is killed because of that here, because of that. But by the occurrence of X in the right hand side, it is made live again. Okay, so First remove and then add. Okay, and the same holds true for the reading from memory. The value of x receives a new value, therefore it must be removed from the L. But all the variables which are used in the index expression for the memory lookup, they must be added to the set of life variables because they are used at that edge. Okay? And now, again, if you have a path, pi, now starting at program point U and go or V, going to the end point of the program, then we kind of can assign can consider the transformation of this path, and this is just by composing these transformations in the right ordering, and that means that the last edge in this path must be this transformation must be applied first. And now let's see here for this little example that what the definitions which we have made, that they are useful. Assuming that at the end point we have the empty set, nothing is life there, then what is life then at program point 4? We would say we have to this is a memory, a writing to memory, so therefore all the variables occurring in this statement are uses, so x and y have to be added to the set of life variables. So therefore at 4 we have x, y as life variables. Now proceeding to program point 3. So that means we have first to remove x, because x is updated here, and then we have to add y, so therefore we have variable y alone here. And then at program point 2 we have to remove y, and then at program point 1 we have to remove x and add y. So this gives us y. And again, so for example, for now we may check whether this definition is correct. So that means, for example, at program point 1, we say we assume that y is alive. So that means in the future we see a use of y before it is overwritten. That's true, because here is a use of y. On the other hand, x is not contained in the set. That means x must be overwritten before it is used. And this is true because it is overwritten before it is used. Okay? And the same, likewise, we might consider for one more example, this program point 3. There we claim that y is life. Y? Okay, so the next edge simply reads the y, and therefore it is life. And on the other hand, x is not life because on that particular edge, x is overwritten. And it is not red. Okay? So therefore this is, at least in this little example, and for these two kind of program points and situations, we see that the transformations which we have, which I have spelled out, and more or less intuitively tried to explain to you, capture the right, the definition. Okay? And, so then now we have this what the effect is of a path, and this effect of a path we have to apply to the set of life variables at program exit to obtain the life variables at a program point along that path. So this is the set of variables which are life along that path at a program point U. Now then, what is life at U is to take the union of all this life variables for all path pi, which start at U and go to the endpoint. Okay. Now, what is the ordering of? We have fixed the set of values with which we want to compute, namely sets of variables. So, but what is the ordering on that set of sets? And now the ordering is, we see the ordering somehow can be read off here. So there this should be the least upper bound operation. And so the least upper, so that the ordering is therefore subset inclusion, the natural ordering on sets. Okay? And the set of variables which we assume here in this definition to be live at program exit, this is this capital X, which I have written down here. Okay, so now assuming that we can compute this L star, and then the transformations which we can perform are the following. If X is not live at a program point V, then we simply can kill the assignment to X. And also, we can kill reads, because we read a value into a variable which never will be accessed. So that's kind of the very simple transformation. And it clearly, if we can apply it, then obviously it improves, because something simply, we cancel out assignments. And now, so what we could, so then there are several things which we have to prove for the, if we, I will not perform the proof, but these are kind of the issues which we have to deal with. That we have to check that these transformations for the individual X edges really compose in a way so that the definition of liveness which I have given you for paths, that they are satisfied. So that is one thing, and that means that is one thing which you have to verify, and that would be due by induction on the length of path. Now, then the second thing is that not only the analysis is correct, but also that the transformation is correct. That is, that means when I have a path and I have something, a variable which is dead along that path at a particular program point, and I cancel out the assignment, that then the values of variables do not change. But that is kind of something weird, because it is not true that the values of variables do not change by removing these assignments to dead variables. The only thing what we can prove is that the values of live variables do not change, and not the values of dead variables, because we remove assignments to dead variables. So if I compare the optimized program with the non-optimized program, that at a certain program point, at the same program point, the two assignments of values to variables may be different. The only thing which we can guarantee is that for live variables they are the same. And if we consider that live variables are the only ones which matter, then the programs are equivalent. So again, we have the notion that we do an optimization, and this optimization does not preserve the semantics in a certain sense, in a very strict sense. It only preserves the semantics if we kind of restrict the observations which we allow for the programs. And if we allow for the live variables, or if we allow for the values which are written to memory, then the two program executions are the same. Okay, so now I guess time is over, but then in the next go, we try to, in the next week, we will kind of see how this L star can be computed, and again, we might wonder, will we be able to compute this merge over all path solution, and the answer will already be, yes, we can. why? Because as it is written, look at the transfer functions, our super duper transfer functions, it's all with union and set minus is like intersection, so it is with union and intersection, and that is, we have proven this is distributive. So in a certain sense we are able to compute all live variables, and this the corresponding discussion and examples and such things that we will look at next week. Thank you for your attention.